Let me go back 2 weeks ago where we were. We kind of left off with the disciples. They were in a boat. You remember the boat? And they were in a storm. Now they're soaking wet because of the storm. And they're in awe of this guy who's in the boat with them. This Jesus Christ. What? Who is this guy? You remember that? They just went through a storm on the Sea of Galilee. And now we get to Mark chapter 5. And let me read Mark 5 verse 1, just the first verse there. Then they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. That should get our attention right there. They went across the lake. Where did they? To the Gerasenes. Do you know anything about this area? The Gerasenes. I got a map up here. I thought this map would be helpful here. They started in Capernaum. That's where Jesus did most of his ministry. But they crossed the lake. Jesus says, let's get in the lake. We need to cross the lake in Mark chapter 4. And then the storm and the calming of the storm in Mark chapter 4. But they're going to the Gerasenes on the other side of the lake. That's on the east side of the lake. This is Gentile territory, which means the entire area over here is unclean. Jesus is taking the disciples to the other side of the lake, which for the disciples, this is the wrong side of the tracks. This is the wrong side of the lake. Nobody goes over here. It's defiled. It's dirty. But here they are. The sky is clear after this terrible storm. The water's calm. The boat is just gliding to shore. And the disciples can't help but this eerie feeling they're experiencing right now. As they're pulling up and they get out of the boat in an area, what I'm trying to describe is a place of total spiritual darkness. Everything unclean. Not only is it a Gentile area, but you read the text here and you realize they just got out of the boat in a cemetery. And once again, to a Jew, I mean, the most unclean thing there is a dead corpse. And here they're surrounded by these tombstones, dead bodies everywhere. And as they're taking all that in, they can't help but to see over in the distance is a herd of pigs. Really? I mean, Gentiles, tombstones, pigs everywhere. And then you also, as you read the text, you get this glimpse. It's full of unclean spirits. Jesus has just led these 12 men who are trying to follow him into the darkest depths of the most contaminated, defiling uncleanliness that you can imagine. I mean, it's not kosher, is what I'm trying to say. This is not kosher at all. In verse 2, when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tombs to meet him. So we got to talk about this crazy man. A man with an evil spirit comes from the tombs to meet him. Verse 3, this man lived in the tombs. In the tombs. Not around, in the tombs. And no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. Apparently they tried. They tried to bind him. They tried to tie him up. This is how we typically deal with evil. We try to restrain it. We try to tie it up, put it in prison, you know, just cast it out of society. We don't want to be around it. In verse 4, for he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the iron on his feet. Just imagine that, the strength that this guy must have had. This is not natural strength. No, something else is going on here. No one was strong enough to subdue him. In verse 5, night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and he would cut himself with stones. And I just want to ask you to imagine yourself being there and experiencing this. As soon as you climb out of the boat, after this terrible storm that you just experienced, you climb out of the boat, and what do you want to do? You want to get back in the boat, and you want to go back in the storm. Any place but here. This is like a horror movie. This is like a Stephen King novel, and nobody wants to be in a Stephen King novel. Not so bad reading it, maybe, but nobody wants to be in it. No. This is a creepy place. The creepy-looking caves on the side of the banks. And out of the darkness, you hear this bone-chilling shriek of this demonic scream that curdles your blood. And here comes this maniac with superhuman strength, and he's charging right at you. And the first thing you notice is the broken chains, and you're thinking, did he just get out of prison? What is this? What's going on here? And he's running down the hill straight at you. He's naked. He's violent. He's screaming. Yeah, that storm was nothing compared to this, all right? And so here you are, and you're hiding behind Jesus, okay, and Jesus doesn't budge. Jesus doesn't budge. And the man runs right up to Jesus, and he falls down right before Jesus. Verse 6 says, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran, and he fell on his knees in front of him. And I would tell you, this is not an act of worship. I don't know what this is, but he's not worshiping. This is a confrontation between two spiritual forces. And it becomes immediately obvious one of the spiritual forces is not that impressive. Falls before Jesus. You go back to verse 2, and it says, the evil spirit came out of the tombs to meet him. And to meet him, that's a military term, as in like going out to battle. This evil spirit is coming out to battle Jesus Christ. As if this evil spirit was posted here like a guard, like a sentry, strategically placed to stop Jesus from entering this territory. You're not allowed here, Jesus. This is Gentile territory. Don't come in here, Jesus. In reading the text, you immediately notice that this demon knows exactly who he's dealing with. And if you remember the storm, when Jesus calmed the storms, the disciples were like, who is this guy? The demon wasn't asking, who is this guy? He knew exactly who he was. He yells out, Son of the Most High God. He recognizes exactly who Jesus is. Verse 2, Jesus got out of the boat, and a man with an evil spirit. What I want to point out here, this is not a mental illness. It's an evil spirit. And just, I would throw this out here. I feel like everything in our world today is a mental illness. We chalk this up to mental illness. This is a mental illness. This is a mental illness. And nobody wants to talk about evil spirits, and as if that's not a thing. That's not a real thing. And Jesus treats it like this is a very real thing. And I would tell you, the longer I've been alive, I'm thinking it's everywhere. It's around us all the time. And this evil spirit, it was wild and dangerous and naked. Have I said naked already? And naked. And he was tormented and isolated and violent, and no one could help him, and he couldn't help himself. And I'm thinking he's been this way for a long time. And humanly speaking, we would look at this guy and think this is a helpless case, a hopeless case. And this is the most severe case of demonic oppression or depression or possession in the entire Bible. It's an extreme case. It was extreme then. It's extreme now. Luke's version tells us that he was driven by demons. Driven by demons. Somehow he was under demonic control, demonic influence. And I read something from Ray Stedman. Ray Stedman is a guy who I respect a whole lot. I like this guy a lot. And this is what he says. He says, the New Testament never actually uses the term demon possession. It is a term which has been invented, but it may not be a very accurate term. The word in Scripture is always demonized. This man has been demonized. Whether it means possession or control or influence, this is the word which is used. It is evident there are various stages and degrees to which demons, evil spirits, can affect or control human beings. And I go back, this was a severe case. Maybe not 90% of the cases aren't very severe at all. And I just wonder how many people around us are being demonized. And I wonder, are we being demonized? Is that possible to be a Christian and still the devil and his demons are still affecting us and influencing us to do evil? And how did this man get this way? And we don't have the answer to that. We don't know how this man got this way. And the closest I've got in the Bible, biblically speaking, is King Saul and how he became demonized. It tells us in 1 Samuel chapter 16, now the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit came from the Lord and tormented him. An evil spirit from the Lord tormented him. And how did this happen to King Saul? And as you read the story of King Saul, it becomes clear that the Spirit of the Lord departed him because he had a rebellious spirit. You see this in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance is like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you, O king. Because you've rejected the Lord, when you reject the word of the Lord, you're setting yourself up for demons to take over. And that's what happened to King Saul. I'm curious if it's happening to people all around us. Is that not what's happening to people all around us today? They're being demonized because they rejected Jesus. In Ephesians 4, this is a good warning for us. Ephesians 4, verse 26 to 27 says, in your anger, do not sin, and do not let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. Do not give the devil a foothold. Apparently, it doesn't take much. It doesn't take much for the devil to come into your world, to come into your home, to come into your life and start influencing you and hurting you and tormenting you and isolating you and making you into a miserable person. Don't allow that to happen. And I'm just curious if it happens. I read this. I thought this was interesting. Maybe this man had such a desire to be free. You think about that. I mean, don't we all have this innate thing in us that we want freedom? We want freedom, and he wanted freedom. And you see it in our world today, people who don't want anything to do with God, they don't want God telling them what to do. They want to be free from God's influence and free from restrictions and free from responsibilities. And he wanted to be free to do what he wanted to do. And you see that in our world all the time, people who want that kind of freedom. And now he has this freedom. No shackles can bind him. No chains can hold him. And he's no longer bound by social conventions that tell him how to dress or how to behave. You know, nobody wants, don't tell me how to dress. Don't tell me how to behave. He has no responsibilities to society because society does not want him in their lives. They don't want to be around him. So now he's totally free. And get this, Romans 6, verse 20. When you were slaves to sin, you were free from control of righteousness. And what benefits did you reap at that time from the things you are now ashamed of? These things resulted in death. Oh, you were free. When you were free from the things of God, you were free. This demonized man, he's free, but he's miserable. And he's isolated. And he's rejected. And he's tormented. Is that what you're after? You want that kind of freedom that makes you miserable and isolated? You keep reading this text in Romans chapter 6, but now that you have been set free from sin and you become slaves to God, I see right there, there's an option. I can be free from sin or I can be free from God. If I'm free from God, what are the benefits? There's no benefits. If I'm free from sin, look at the benefits there. Now that you've been set free from sin and have become slaves to God, the benefits you reap leads to holiness, and the result is eternal life. And I would tell you the result is abundant life. The results are a blessed life filled with love and joy and peace. And it's all because freedom leads me to misery. Freedom from God leads me to misery. But being a slave to God, being a servant of God, being a child of God, I belong to God. And because of that, okay, I've got responsibilities, and there are rules, and there's regulations, but I belong to God. And with that, there is blessing. So much blessing. Let me also talk just some of the symptoms of being demonized. What are some of the symptoms here? With this guy, what we see, he's naked. Did I tell you he was naked? Bible says he wore no clothing. What do you do with that? Is he an exhibitionist? I don't know. I don't know how far to take this, but I would tell you in our world today that one of the portals for demonization is sexual addiction, sexual deviant behavior, pornography. These are some of the deadly traps that Satan uses to destroy us. And we see this. We see this all the time, but nobody wants to acknowledge it. Nobody wants to admit it. And the Bible says we are to honor marriage. We need to see sex as a gift from God, but it needs to be done God's way, in a way that God tells us. And the marriage bed is sacred, according to Hebrews 13, verse 4. But Satan wants to take everything that God has given us, these beautiful gifts that God has given us, and Satan wants to pervert it and turn it into something that will destroy you. So that's just one area. But here's another thing. He lives in the tombs. And I would tell you another symptom is being obsessed with death. And tell me this. Do you not see this in our world today? So many people obsessed with this morbid obsession with death and dying. I feel like I see this so much. And then I read this. Jeffrey Dahmer, for all the older people in this room who remember who Jeffrey Dahmer is, a serial killer. Don't want to talk about him too much. But here's the thing. Someone offered tours of all the bars where serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer found his victims. You know, a guy was offering tours. You know, go with me. I'll take you to all the places where he found his victims. And the tours sold out. What does that tell you about our world today? How sick our world is today. And I just want to offer this up to you that if you have this morbid obsession with death, I'm thinking Satan has he's got a hold of you there. This is sick. It's sick. The other thing I see is violent behavior. Verse 4 says he had often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart, broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. He was violent, and he was out of control. And is that not rampant in our world today? People who are violent and out of control, you see school shootings, mass shootings. News doesn't even talk about it anymore. We've become numb to it. It happens so often. That is not of God. This is, Jesus tells us, this is exactly what Satan does. He's a murderer and he's a liar and he's come to steal and kill and destroy. And you see people who are stealing, killing, and destroying because they've rejected Jesus Christ and they've become demonized. Another thing is self-abuse. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and he would cut himself with stones. You know, the epidemic of cutting yourself, that's nothing new. It's been going on for 2,000 years. And what I read, the reason people do that, there's such a pain inside, and they can't understand it, and they can't identify it. They don't know how to deal with it, so they cut themselves physically to minimize the pain that's on the inside. That's what they're doing. It's a sign of being demonized, under the influence of demons. All right, so that kind of describes this man. And I want to go on. I want you to see how this man prayed to Jesus. Now, praying to Jesus, that might be an overstatement here. He begged and he pleaded. You see, verse 6, when he saw Jesus sit from a distance, he ran and he fell on his knees in front of him. And he shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" As if you don't belong here, Jesus. And then Jesus is saying, I belong everywhere. But verse 7, swear to God. He says, swear to God that you won't torture me. So there's the first part of his prayer. He's praying, swear to God that you won't torture me, which I think is pretty rich. I mean, what are these demons doing to this man? They're torturing this man. And now they're asking Jesus, don't torture us. Hypocrites, that's what they are, hypocrites. In verse 9, and when Jesus asked him, what is your name? And this is interesting to me. Jesus says, what is your name? As if, do you even know who you are? These demons have got such a control on you. Do you even know who you are? And he cried out, my name is Legion, for we are many. Right, Legion, what's that mean? Legion is a military term describing 6,000 soldiers. I don't know if there were 6,000 soldiers in this guy. He's just saying there's a lot. There's a bunch of them, and they've completely taken over me. Jesus is not facing a demon. He's facing an army of demons. And what you see here, you got the Messiah, Jesus Christ, versus a literal army of demons. And a couple of notes here I've got. This is the only time in the New Testament where Jesus asked a demon to identify himself by name. The only time that Jesus ever asked what his name is. And the reason that's important, and I've experienced this myself, sometimes people assume that Jesus asked the demon his name as a strategy for casting him out. They say that one of the tricks of the trade for casting out demons is you got to be able to name the demon. I had somebody tell me that. And here, Jesus doesn't need to know his name to throw him out. This is stupid. Jesus never asked any other demon his name, nor does he use the demon's name in this case to cast him out. He's just asking the guy, do you know who you are? And the guy says, my name is Legion, because there's a bunch of them inside of me. And then he goes on with this prayer, this demonized man. He goes on, he begged Jesus again and again not to send them out of the area. He's pleading with Jesus, begging Jesus, praying to Jesus, don't send us out of the area. And when you see that word beg, that tells you who's in control here, doesn't it? These demons are not in control. Jesus has all control. These demons are no match for Jesus. You got to see that. And in verse 11, a large herd of pigs were feeding on a nearby hillside. And the demons begged Jesus, send us among the pigs. Allow us to go into them. So there's the prayer. don't torture us. Don't send us from the area. Send us into those pigs. That's what they're praying to Jesus for. And how's Jesus answer this prayer? Okay, sure, deal. Okay. That's what, in verse 13, he gave them permission, and the evil spirits came out and went into the pigs. Well, that's way too easy. Okay. Why would Jesus agree to this? Why would Jesus agree? Why did 2,000 pigs have to die? First of all, these Gentiles raising bacon, for a Jew, that's just wrong. But this is not the point. This is proof. The reason Jesus allowed this was to give proof to his awesome power. He was making their invisible defeat visible to us, to the people in that region. Because anybody can say, be gone, demon, and you just say, oh, it was a mental illness. But when you see 2,000 pigs laying around, you know, what happened to those 2,000? Mental illness? There's 2,000 dead pigs here. So the pigs are proof of Jesus' power. Verse 13, a herd of about 2,000 in number rushed down the steep bank and into the lake, and they were drowned. This demonized man was being tortured and destroyed. It was a self-destructive maniac. And as soon as these demons go into the pigs become self-destructive maniac pigs. Or would it be piggyacs? I don't know what it's telling you. And I read, pigs are great swimmers. Pigs are great swimmers. Why did they die? Because demons aren't good swimmers. That's what I'm thinking. So they go into the pig, but the demons are out to destroy, and they destroyed these pigs. It's obvious that it's the same demons. The same demons that were in this man are now in the pigs. Jesus makes it impossible to deny there's a miracle here. This is not mental illness. This is demonic. And I would tell you, it's not about the pigs. People get so lost on that and obsessed about the pigs. It's not about the pigs. It's about the power of Jesus. And people say, well, it's not fair. All those pigs, who owns the pigs? Jesus owns it all. It all belongs to him. And if that's why he chooses, that's why he created the pigs, for him to receive the glory, then there you go. Verse 13, he gave them permission to go into the pigs. In Matthew, it just says, he said, go, and they came out. He said one word, go. That's how this cosmic battle between Jesus and these demons, it lasted a second. One word, go. The whole thing, you go back to the storm, it would show you that Jesus has power over all creation. He can calm a storm. And then we read the story, and what we need to see, Jesus has all power to eliminate evil. He takes on a legion of demons. 1 John 3, verse 8, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. And get this, only Jesus Christ can do this. And I think this is very profound here. All the founders of all the other religions, and they could have been great guys, I don't know, but they couldn't do this. They couldn't eliminate evil. Did any of them show the power to eradicate evil from the world? No. They weren't even able to eradicate evil from their own hearts, much less the universe. Only one person has proven he has the power to eliminate evil, and that is Jesus Christ. And there's the question. Are we sick of evil? Do we want evil to be addressed? Do we want evil to be eliminated? And if so, who are you going to go to? Only Jesus Christ has the ability to do this. Only Jesus Christ has the power to do this. And the story goes on. That's just a third of the story, but that's a big part of the story. Now you go on here, and now we got to talk about the crazy people. Not the crazy man, but the crazy people. It says in verse 14, those tending the pigs ran off, and they reported this to the town and the countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. And when they came to Jesus, they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons sitting there, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. So as soon as these demons go into the pigs run off the cliff, the pigs all die, and the hired hands, the guys who are watching the pigs, they go and they run and tell everybody in the village. The demons are gone. The demons are gone. Kind of like Paul Revere. The demons are gone. But not like that. And all the people, they go out to investigate. Was it they went and they saw, and what did they see? They saw this man who had been possessed, sitting there, dressed, and in his right mind. And how do they respond? I'm thinking, a parade. We need a parade. We need a national holiday to honor Jesus. Wouldn't that be great? Or we can build a statue in the city, in the center of the city, build a statue to Jesus, you know, or at least give our lives to him and ask him to save our souls. Is that what they did? Did they do any of that? Did they do any of that? For he's a jolly good fellow? None of that. None of that. They prayed. And what was their prayer? They begged Jesus to leave. Verse 17, then the people began to plead with Jesus to leave their region. And I would just like to point out, I think that's the saddest verse in the whole Bible. Jesus came to bring life, and they chose death. Jesus came to bring freedom, and they chose bondage. Jesus came to bring light, and they preferred the darkness. You would think they would be grateful that this dangerous man has been cast out of their society. This dangerous man has been healed. Man, if Jesus can heal this man, think about what he could do for the rest of us. If Jesus can bring freedom to him, think about the freedom he can bring to us. Think about all that Jesus could do for us, but they beg him to leave. And then I got to ask you before I move on from this, that, what is your attitude about Jesus? Do you want Jesus in your life? Do you want Jesus to bless your family? Do we want Jesus to bless our country? Or do we want him to leave? And why on earth would we want that? And yet, there's so many people who don't want anything to do with Jesus. Why? And it tells us here, because they were afraid. Afraid of what? I get this. I actually get this. I know what they're afraid of. He is powerful. And that's scary. He's the most powerful person they've ever encountered. More powerful than this demonized man who could rip off chains. And they were scared of his power and probably even more scared of his holiness. This man who manhandles evil. And that's great when you're talking about this evil man who lives in the tombs. But what about our evil? What's he going to do with my evil? What's he going to do to me? And the evil man, I'm thinking he was sick of his evilness. Here's the problem. These people aren't sick of their evil. They're not sick of it yet. Jesus is light, and it would be great for him to shine his light on the darkness in the tombs. But not on my darkness. Not on my darkness. John 3, verse 19 says, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men loved darkness instead of the light because their deeds were evil. And see where this leads? When you love your darkness more than light, then you're the one who's telling Jesus to leave, begging Jesus to leave. People are forever complaining about evilness in our world, the existence of evilness in our world. And when Jesus comes with the solution, they say, no, thank you. We don't want it. And it turns out these people aren't quite as anti-evil as what they thought they were. Just wonder if we're as anti-evil as what we think we are. When you think about all that Jesus wants to do in our lives, and look at how we treat Jesus. What's his response? How did Jesus, when they begged him to leave, what does he do? What does he do? This is interesting to me. Verse 18, he basically says, okay. You see him, as Jesus was getting in the boat, they beg him to leave their region. And the next verse, as he was getting in the boat, he was leaving. You don't want me here? I'll leave. He left. He's getting ready to leave. And, which is interesting. The demons begged Jesus, send us in the pigs. Jesus says, okay. These people, they begged Jesus to leave the region. And he says, okay. And as far as we know, he never came back. Be very careful what you pray for. All right, one last thing I want to point out here. the crazy calling of this. What happened next? Verse 18, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed, begged to go with him. And Jesus did not let him. He said, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. So this man, he prays to Jesus. What's his prayer? He said, let me go with you. That's his prayer. He begged. Once again, that word beg is three times in this text. The demons begged, the people begged, and now this man's begging. He's begging, Lord, let me go with you. He pleaded to go with him. You know why? Because these people are crazy. They don't want you here. I want you here. I want to be with you, Jesus. Wherever you go, I want to go there. And Jesus said, no. Weird. The only guy who's asking for something good, and Jesus says no to his prayer. Jesus did not let him go. And then what I think is probably the most important verse in this whole text, Mark 5, verse 19, Jesus says, go home to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. Look at that. Go and tell your family about the power of Jesus. Go and tell your family in your community, in your home. Go tell them about the mercy of Jesus. Tell them how much the Lord has done for you. Let me ask you, has the Lord done anything for you? Has Jesus done anything for you? Can you think of anything he's done for you? And I'm thinking some of us, oh my gosh, he's changed everything. He's changed everything. What I want you to see here, verse 20, so the man went away and he began to tell in the Decapolis how much Jesus has done for him. It says he began to tell, and that word tell does not do it justice. And you look it up in the Greek. I did look it up in the Greek. It's actually the word proclaim. Tell is just too soft. The NIV totally got it wrong on this one. Go and proclaim. He went and proclaimed. He went and preached. Jesus made this man a preacher. Yeah, Jesus, he just cursed the guy, didn't he? He made the man a preacher. And what I think is really crazy about this, I don't think any church would hire this guy. Would a church hire this guy? I mean, for no seminary degree, only one day of training, terrible reputation. I mean, worst resume ever. Would you hire this guy? But Jesus called the man to preach, and he made him a preacher. Not just a preacher, he made him a missionary. And he goes to his people, to the Decapolis is what it's called, the 10 cities of that region. And he proclaimed all that Jesus had done for him. He proclaimed the mercy that he had experienced from Jesus Christ. And get this, verse 20, and all the people were amazed. And all the people were amazed. Okay, amazed doesn't cut it. You can be amazed at Jesus all day long. That's not going to save you. And you see this throughout the book of Mark. People, Jesus does something and the people are amazed. Okay, yeah, great, but amazed is not going to take your sins away. No one ever had their sins forgiven because they were amazed at Jesus. No one went to heaven because they were amazed at Jesus. Amazement raises their eyebrows and then walks away. No change, no transformation. You got to do better than be amazed at Jesus. You got to be surrendered to Jesus. You got to put your faith in Jesus in humble, reverent adoration because you recognize what he's done for you. You recognize what he's done for you. Do you recognize what Jesus has done for you? Jesus didn't come to help religious people become more religious. He didn't come to help good people get better. And you see it in this text right here. Jesus came to invade occupied territory, to cross into places where evil had a long-held stronghold on people's lives. Jesus went to those places, and he gave them freedom. And you look at this story here, and it reminds me of four things here I see, that sometimes evil can take hold of a person. You see it 2,000 years ago. I think we're seeing it today. Evilness is taking hold of people. But you see in this story, Jesus can set the captive free. Jesus can bring freedom. Jesus knows how to cast these demons out. And another thing you see here, not everyone's going to accept it. Not everybody wants this. And that drives me crazy. I don't know what to do about that. And one more thing I see here, sometimes the biggest difference you and I can make is right in our hometown. There's a book out there, Bloom Where You're Planted. God has you where you are, with your family, at your workplace. Not saying that you're going to always be at that workplace, but wherever God has you, that's where you're called to. That's where you're supposed to be preaching. That's where you're called to be a missionary. Now, what God called this man to do, he's calling you to do. One more detail from the story. Actually, go back to Mark chapter 4 and what you see when Jesus says, we're going to go to the other side of the lake. Let's get in the boat. We got to go to the other side of the lake. Why did Jesus go to the other side of the lake? He went there for this man and from what I can see, only for this man. A deeply troubled man who needed to be set free. Jesus went through a storm to get to this guy. And Jesus cast out the demons. He didn't do anything else there. And he got back in the boat, and he went back to Galilee. The only reason he crossed the lake was to deliver this demonized man. And the point is, if Jesus was willing to cross dangerous, stormy body of water just to help this one troubled man, you need to know he would do the same thing for you. He would cross anything he needed to cross to get to you, to set you free, even if you were the only one. That's how much he loves you. That's the Lord that we serve. The Lord who set us free. That's the Lord we worship.